We'll start with jobs. We'll end with debt and deficit. In between, scooters, movies, and coal miners. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 2nd of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to do a little labor market 1-2-3 by way of getting going today. Item one, this morning, the private payroll processor ADP gave us its guess as to how many jobs the economy added last month. 428,000, which is a nice hefty number, but well short of what everybody had been guessing, which was closer to a million. Speaking of million, that gets us to labor market marker number two, the weekly report on new unemployment claims that'll come tomorrow. It'll be at or near a million people freshly out of work, as it's been every week for 5+ months. And speaking of months, Friday morning will bring us the August jobs report. That's item three. We probably added jobs, and the unemployment rate probably went down. There endeth the predictions. But there is a common thread that's running through the American labor market right now once you get past all the data and the indicators. As Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, millions of Americans are facing the prospect of long-term unemployment.
COVID-19 has not been good to the live events business. Rock concerts and festivals pretty much shut down on a dime in early spring. That's when Jason George of Benton Harbor, Michigan got laid off.
Like many of my coworkers in the industry, we've been furloughed for a very long time.
Initially, George was on temporary layoff from his job managing shows for a big event promoter. He got on unemployment, his employer kept paying his benefits, and he waited for a callback. But by midsummer, still no concerts or callbacks. And as of yesterday, George's employer has made his temporary layoff permanent. Benefits stop at the end of the month.
It does feel different because there's not that safety net, I guess, there anymore that I could possibly go back sooner rather than later. So it does feel official, like we're kind of on our own to figure things out for ourselves.
A lot more workers are likely to end up like Jason George in coming months.
It's very unlikely that if you've been furloughed for this length of time that you're going to go back.
Daniel Sternberg is lead data scientist at Gusto, an HR platform for small businesses. He says if you got furloughed back in March, there was a 30% chance you'd be called back by April.
Because your company received PPP funds or was able to reopen in some capacity. But then if we go out into future months, smaller and smaller percentages returning to work.
And by July, a majority of furloughed workers were still waiting to be called back. And people laid off early in the pandemic are now approaching what the Labor Department defines as long-term unemployment, more than 26 weeks without a job. Jobless benefits start to run out, people go through their savings to pay the bills, and long-term unemployment decreases workers' chances of getting re-employed. Harvard economist Gabriel Chodorow-Reich and a colleague at the Fed have been projecting this out.
In our baseline simulation in early 2021, 4.5 million people will have been unemployed for more than 26 weeks. A more pessimistic scenario, that number rises to more than 5 million.
That would still be fewer than the peak of 6.5 million caused by the Great Recession. Recent polls have found that only a third of laid-off workers think they'll be able to return to their jobs, and a quarter of those who are still working worry they'll lose their jobs as the pandemic drags on. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Here's a labor market indicator that goes to prove the case that Mitchell was talking about. United Airlines said today it's going to furlough 16,000 people come October 1st when restrictions tied to federal bailout money go away. The good part, if you can call it that, is that that 16,000 is less than half the furloughs United had been guessing they would have to do. I gave this a quick nod yesterday. We will dig in a bit today. I'm talking about American manufacturing. It is doing really well. An index out this week showed the highest level of activity since 2018, which, yeah, wasn't that long ago, but is a really long time ago, you know? Now, how long can that last? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that one.
So the PMI says business is good for U.S. manufacturers. And you know what? Business is good for Michael Arreton, CEO of Sterling Drive Ventures.
we're now going gangbusters. We're, you know, virtually at capacity in production. We've hired people. We're looking to hire more people.
The company makes plastic parts, swabs for coronavirus test kits, window parts, also toys. It's all going very well. Overall, factory shipments in the economy are only down 3.5% from February. Manufacturing feels like it's coming back. Manufacturing is also suffering. Harlan Stone is CEO of HMTX Industries.
This is really, truly, this is the weirdest time I've ever seen.
HMTX makes luxury vinyl flooring. It manufactures outside the U.S. but sells into the U.S. market. It's had record sales and record revenue, but there's a but.
Whereas our home improvement business is great, we also supply to hotels and restaurants, a separate segment of the economy, and that is badly depressed. So it's really a tale of two cities.
On the whole, it seems there's more positive than negative in manufacturing for now. Sam Coffin is an economist with UBS.
What's going on right now, we think, is that businesses are refilling their inventories. They're restocking after this period in which they couldn't buy stuff. After that period of restocking, there could be a bit of a pause.
Could be a long pause, and same goes for the economy as a whole. Ernie Tedeschi is an economist at Evercore ISI.
It's going to take much longer than just a few months. It's going to take years. This recovery is looking more and more like it will be like the recovery from the Great Recession.
Tedeschi says after the 08 recession, the country didn't reach full employment for probably around a decade, if at all. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
At the risk of repeating myself, more all-time highs on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Remittances is the word used to describe money that expats send back to their home countries. It's a lot of money in the aggregate, and it's often critical for those economies. Last year, migrants from Latin America and the Caribbean sent nearly $100 billion home. And early in this pandemic, as you might imagine, the World Bank figured remittances from the United States to Latin America would fall 20%. But as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, payments sent to some Latin American countries have in fact bounced back.
For the past 8 years, 24-year-old Byron Chamorro's father has been sending money to his wife, Byron's mom in Guatemala. Then the pandemic hit. Lots of people stayed home. But not Chamorro's father. He delivers food for an Italian restaurant in Brooklyn.
He actually started working on the weekend, which was something he did not do.
And the money he remits to Guatemala?
The amount that he sends increased a little bit during the pandemic.
$150 a week instead of $100. Mark Hugo Lopez with the Pew Research Center says in April there was a steep decline in remittances to El Salvador and the Dominican Republic, but those have rebounded. He says that's because migrants from those countries tend to do essential work, farming, food production, hospitality. Meanwhile, remittances to Mexico never declined at all. In fact, they've been increasing all year.
Many Mexican immigrants have been in the U.S. for so long that they're able to navigate better some of the uncertainties about the labor market associated with the COVID-19 downturn.
That's good news for Mexico, which is grappling with the loss of tourism. Roy Germano, a scholar at NYU, says that's true of a lot of Latin America.
But often in these countries, there really isn't much of a safety net to speak of, and migrants play that safety net role.
Diego Vacaflores, an economics professor at Texas State University, plays that role. He sends money monthly to his parents in Bolivia. When he saw the shortages of products happening here in the U.S.,
I knew that was going to happen eventually in Latin America, and I tried to get my family to be prepared for that, to do it before things ran out of in the market.
So he sent them an extra grant this spring. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
After a bunch of delays, the new Christopher Nolan movie, Tenet, is hitting U.S. movie theaters this week, as in actual theaters. Notably not in New York or big parts of California like Los Angeles, but in the 45-ish states where they're open, Tenet is going to be on a lot of screens. It's the first big-budget theatrical release in months, so there is, of course, a lot riding on it for theater owners who are trying to get to the other side of this pandemic. Some theater people are trying to survive in other ways, including Stephanie Silverman. She's one of the 10 people we've been following in our series called The United States of Work. She runs an independent theater in Nashville called The Bell Court. And she sent us an audio diary she recorded this past Saturday night.
It is the end of the night for us here at the Bell Court Theater in Nashville. We just wrapped our first night of our COVID pivot to drive-in movies. It's about 11 o'clock, and we showed North by Northwest tonight, Alfred Hitchcock's remarkable film, in our parking lot. And it was a blast. The movie looked gorgeous. The storms magically blew around the city that were looking pretty ominous when we all got here tonight. The people were so excited and so eager to be back doing something together, but also really careful. Lots of masking, lots of caretaking, lots of distancing. So all the things we were hoping to see and a little maybe nervous about weren't there. And I guess most of all, it was just really great to be back in person, even with masks and distancing, with the staff of the Bell Court working together. It's imperfect, but it's as perfect as it's going to get right now. And it's feeling a little bit like a corner that we've turned.
Oh, Matt, this is silly.
I know, but I'm sentimental.
All in all, a pretty special night.
Stephanie Silverman, Nashville, Tennessee, the Bell Court Theater. Coming up,
I've talked with guys who have been fighting for up to 20 years.
And still, they don't get what they are entitled to. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so here you go. Dow Industrial's up 454 points today. 1.5%, 1.5% is another way to say that. 29,100. The NASDAQ up 116 points, 0.9%, finished at 12,056. The S&P 500 gained 54 points, 1.5% there. Also 1.5%, finished at 3580. Fantasy sports gambling company DraftKings got a lift today from one famous gambler. Michael Jordan is his name. The former Chicago Bull and current majority owner of the Charlotte Hornets will be joining the DraftKings advisory board in exchange for an equity stake in that company. DraftKings stock closed 8% higher. Bond prices higher today as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 0.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The coronavirus is changing college life as we know. It's changing it a lot. It's changing a standard precursor to college life as well. A judge here in California has ruled that the University of California cannot use either the ACT or the SAT in admissions decisions because limited access to those standardized tests puts students with disabilities at a disadvantage, a situation made worse by the pandemic. While the education testing industrial complex is a $1.1 billion industry, Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports it is not without its vulnerabilities.
Last year, the UC system said standardized tests would be optional in the future. Mounting pressure around alleged cultural bias and the Varsity Blues bribery scandal led to that decision. With Tuesday's ruling, the University of California will have to drop the SAT and ACT requirement immediately. Many schools nationwide have already decided to ditch the tests.
Truly, high school GPA is by far and away the best predictor of.
Brian Troyer is Marquette University's Dean of Undergraduate Admissions. His school went test-free after finding the scores didn't really say much about how well students would go on to do in college. Now, COVID-19 is accelerating the move towards making tests optional. Many schools have at least temporarily suspended the use of tests. David Hawkins is a spokesperson for the National Association for College Admission Counseling.
You are standing at a crossroads. This COVID-19 disruption has short-circuited the extensive discussion that many colleges have about going test optional.
For years, advocates have argued that eliminating the standardized tests would help level the playing field for students who can't afford hundreds of dollars for test prep tutoring. David Gruenbaum coaches the College Bound. He's not too worried about his business, which is part of the billion-dollar test prep industry, taking a hit.
What can they use to make decisions? Junior year last year was useless, that the grades were completely worthless.
So far, COVID-19 has derailed students for two semesters, and standardized testing may not survive. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
For those of you who are out and about again, you might have seen those e-scooters are back, zipping past you just a little bit too fast, perhaps. Parking in the way, of course. Scooter and bike shares have been coming back pretty quickly, actually. Micro-mobility is the phrase the experts use. And a new report suggests people are finding new ways to use them to get out and about, which are, in turn, becoming new opportunities for this relatively new slice of this economy, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Americans' use of shared bikes and scooters before the pandemic was growing at 60% a year. And then in March, we all stopped moving. But by this summer, New York City's bike share saw ridership nose ahead of July 2019. Alex Engel is with the National Association of City Transportation Officials, which has a new report suggesting that micromobility is back.
You're seeing people use it to do their everyday errands. You're seeing people use these bike share systems at different times of days than you saw before. So people are using them to see friends and take trips recreationally as well.
Some local governments are offering discounts to essential workers who are hopping on the shared bikes too. Now, the e-scooter business was already struggling financially when the pandemic hit, says David Zipper, visiting fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School.
The leading players, Lime, Bird, and Spin, removed their scooters from the vast majority of cities. And there was a lot of concern about whether scooters could even exist in the future.
Then people started emerging from their lockdowns, and they really wanted alternatives to buses and subways. And scooters scooted back.
People may not be going to and from school the way they used to. It's going to create some opportunities as well as some needs for these micromobility companies to rethink the role they're going to play.
So there's opportunity, and there's uncertainty and responsibility. Courtney Ehrlichman is a transportation consultant. She says the next push is to encourage micromobility companies to serve neighborhoods without good links to public transportation.
There's this really intense pressure on these e-scooter companies to address these transit deserts.
First, though, these scooter companies will probably want to figure out how to make money. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There was a study out a couple of years ago from the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health showing that the incidence of advanced black lung disease, what coal miners get after a lifetime spent working underground, was the highest it's ever been, especially in central Appalachia, Virginia, Kentucky, and West Virginia. Congress passed a law back in 1969 that promised miners compensation if black lung kept them from being able to work. 50 years later, that law is honored most often in the breach. Chris Hamby is a reporter at the New York Times. The fight miners have had to wage to get the compensation they are due is the subject of his new book. It's called Soul Full of Coal Dust. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
First, I want to do a little bit of cast of characters here because it's important people understand, I think, the personalities involved. It's so elemental what these people go through and what the characters in your book did. Tell me, first of all, about the miner that you focus on. His name is Gary Fox.
Gary was born in an area that is today Beckley, West Virginia, and he was born into an old coal camp, didn't have a lot of money growing up, and so he was very determined to, you know, provide a better life for his family. And the best way to do that was coal mining.
And he gets sick, and I don't want to spoil the details of the story, but he eventually winds up being represented by a late-in-life attorney, actually. He goes to law school at the age of 53, a guy by the name of John Klein. Tell us about him.
That's right. John is an interesting character in which he, you know, came to the coal fields of southern West Virginia from New York. Ultimately, then goes to work at a medical clinic, helping miners get their benefits claims started. And it's while he's working there that he starts to see what he believes is a sort of a systematic scheme to defraud miners out of their rightfully due benefits. And he starts fighting as a lay representative and eventually goes to law school at age 53 mm-hmm. so that he can represent these guys. And that's when he intersects with Gary Fox.
What is the mechanism by which coal companies, through attorneys and law firms, and you detail one of them in the book, but there's a standard, it's sort of an SOP, right, that these companies do to not have to pay these benefits?
The word in the coal fields was you basically had to have one foot in the grave to win a claim. Miners would fight these cases for, you know, I've talked with guys who have been fighting for up to 20 years. You know, there are all sorts of tactics that are taken to that. But the one that John Klein really latched onto was that the leading law firm for many coal companies in the region was essentially, as he believed, withholding key medical evidence in cases, and miners were wrongfully being denied benefits. And he sort of waged this 15-year battle with this law firm and with the industry to bring this to light, and ultimately led to some pretty meaningful changes as a result of his case with Gary Fox.
The thing that kept coming to my mind as I was reading this book was that justice in this country, and look, it's got its flaws, and we certainly have been made more aware of that in the last 90 days on a lot of levels, but we're supposed to have a system of adversarial justice where two parties can go into a courtroom and on equal footing have a discussion of a case on the merits. And it seems to me that this is maybe the baldest example of powerful interests having all the information and all the assets, and literally a guy who was born in a coal camp, for crying out loud, not having anything, and that's why he can't win.
This system accentuates the resource disparities that exist in sort of the American legal system as it exists today, and it's particularly stark because the stakes are so high for these miners, and it can mean whether they get modest monthly payments and medical compensation or whether they're sort of relegated to, you know, essentially a slow death and dealing with poverty.
Yeah. And look, we should give a shout out here to Howard Berkus at National Public Radio, with whom you have worked and who, you know, did stories. If you've never heard a coal miner with black lung disease trying to breathe, I recommend you go back and find some of Howard's stories. What is the current state of play about medical disclosure laws in the wake of this fight that John Klein and Gary Fox fought?
What was really remarkable to me was that this small but scrappy coalition of people were able to win some remarkable reforms, and companies today do have to disclose all of the evidence that they yet, and that has actually led to a number of miners winning their claims. You know, as a reporter, it's easy to become cynical, but this story and what happened was truly inspiring to me, and it was really a privilege to get to tell it.
Chris Hemby wrote the book. It's a great read. I got to tell you that. It's called Soul Full of Coal Dust, The Fight for Breath and Justice in Appalachia. Chris, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
We've got an excerpt of Chris's book online about the first time Gary Fox and John Klein met. As I said, it's a good read. You can find that excerpt at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a slightly more serious look at one of my favorite economic reports, the Fed's Beige Book, the central bank's regional look at the economy, comes out 8 times a year. Usually it's a bunch of quirky anecdotal examples of how this economy is doing, and to be sure there were this time as well. But there were also 27 uses of the word uncertain or uncertainty in the 32 pages of economic text. Also, 4 of the Fed's 12 districts cited childcare as a recurring issue in employment in this country. All right, we are going, but not without your midweek moment of economic context, federal debt edition. The Congressional Budget Office said today that in the next fiscal year, the one that starts October the 1st, the amount of government debt is going to be bigger than the entire American economy for the first time since World War II. Is that a big deal? Yes, in a way, but it's not that big a deal right now. Also, says the CBO, because over the next decade, federal deficits, that's the annual budget shortfall, they are going to be lower than expected because interest rates are so low and there's basically no inflation either. So there you go. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They're going in, so the rest of us don't have to. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.